Good evening and welcome behind the news for September 23rd, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got one long interview taking up almost all of the show tonight with Michael Hart, co-author with Antonio Negri of the new book, Multitude, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire. I'll have a little more to say about that a couple minutes from now, but first some announcements and some headlines. I've been asked to announce this fundraiser for the Brecht Forum coming up Saturday, October 2nd, a week from this Saturday. It promises party by the people and party for the people, a fundraiser for the Brecht Forum starting at 8 p.m. going until which probably doesn't mean 4:30 a.m., but, you know, the ending is indefinite. The Brecht Forum, of course, at 122 West 27th Street, 10th floor, but not for much longer, and that's the reason for the party. The Brecht Forum will be moving, and it's going to cost some money. They need to raise significant amounts of cash, and it's only going to come from the public, you, people who have supported and enjoyed the Brecht Forum over the years. For 30 years, the Forum has served as a community space for political education and organizing, as a sponsor for dozens of projects getting off the ground. As they say, we've provided space for your meetings, trainings, report backs, and fundraisers, and now we're calling all the organizations and activists who rely on the Brecht Forum not only to keep the organization afloat, but to help us grow into a space that can serve the left better for the long haul towards liberation. And they're about to sign a lease on a very snazzy new space, I'm told. I haven't seen it, but it sounds really terrific. But it's going to take some money to make the move and to make that space habitable. So the party, Saturday, October 2nd, featuring the Welfare Poets, 512, DJ Aiden, DJ Carlito, DJ Chris Maestro, DJ Eric Mons, and our own DJ Kat Aaron from Rise Up Radio. So check it out Sunday, October 2nd, 8 p.m. until the wee hours, 122 West 27th Street, 10th floor. And in the economic headlines this week, first of all, the weekly tally of jobless claims for the week ending last Friday, that is the weekly count of the number of people who've just lost their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits. That rose by 14,000 last week, on top of the 18,000 rise the previous week. 350,000 people making their first-time claims for unemployment insurance. And that number was probably boosted by the hurricanes in Florida, but still a little persistently high. It's been stuck around the 340,000, 350,000 range for several months now, and is consistent with a decent but not rapid pace of job growth. So we'll see if when the hurricane effects clear, if the labor market shows any signs of life, but it's not looking so great right now. The ABC Money Magazine weekly poll of consumer attitudes fell 2 points to -9, which is about a little below its average range for the 20 years that this index has been in existence. People reporting a slightly gloomier evaluation of the national economy. Again, that sort of stuck. Rose very sharply in the early part of the summer, fell off in the late part of the summer, and now has been stabilizing. But not a great number, not a terrible number. The political implications are that the public seems economically not too discontented, but not too content either. So it's not breaking one way or the other. The Federal Reserve released its minutes of its policymaking meetings last August, and it said that it thinks the economy is only showing a weakness because of high oil prices, and once that bad influence passes, it is back off to the races again. So they will continue as a sustained tightening cycle. So that's what they thought in August. We'll see if they continue to believe that. They did raise interest rates at their last meeting. No surprise there. But the question is what they'll do in their next meetings in the last couple of months of the year. The leading indicators, though, are not suggesting that the conference board's, that the Fed's evaluation of the U.S. economy is so accurate. The conference board's index of leading indicators fell for the third straight month, which is usually a sign of impending recession. And the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index fell also last week. It seems to be stabilizing, but at a fairly weak rate of change. So those are suggesting economic slowdown over the next several months and not an acceleration. south of the border, weaker economic growth in Argentina, an uptick in Brazilian unemployment, and also a significant rise in Mexican unemployment. So the slowdown in the U.S. economy seems to be being felt in the southern part of the hemisphere pretty strongly. So let's take this little musical break, and I'll be back to introduce Michael Hart. And that was a jazz violin version of the Internazionale by Stefan Grappelli, who is a French violinist of Italian origin, died a couple of years ago, and most famous for his collaboration with Django Reinhardt, I believe in the 1930s. And since we're talking about empire and multitude with Michael Hart throughout the program, that seemed appropriate musical selection. So we'll have two more versions of the great hymn of international working class solidarity throughout the program. Michael Hart and Antonio Negri published a book a couple of years ago called Empire, which became an international mega-hit bestseller. It resulted in a photograph of Michael Hart appearing in the New York Times, taking up about a quarter of their Arts and Ideas page, lots and lots of people at least buying and carrying around Empire, if not necessarily reading it. That book was very heavy going and made several theoretical assertions. It was mostly theoretical, operating at a very high level of abstraction. And proposed a thesis, among other things, that the old model of empire that we know of nation-states, individual nation-states owning pieces of real estate in the poorer parts of the world and controlling them directly, that model was now obsolete, and that the power today is exercised in a much more dispersed and decentralized fashion. Certainly the United States still a very powerful country, but not alone, and certainly not without a need for cooperation from its partners in hierarchy. When the Iraq War, in the run-up to the Iraq War, and the bellicose and nationalist rhetoric coming out of the Bush administration, it caused a lot of people to question the empire thesis and to cling to old theories of U.S. dominance, U.S. supremacy. But now it seems that with the nasty outturn, as economists say, of things in Iraq, that maybe this is not the old world of the 19th century or even the golden age of the 1950s and 1960s when the United States was unchallenged in its preeminence, political and military preeminence in the world, and that maybe really this was a much more dispersed and multilateral kind of form of power than the traditionalists were thinking. Anyway, there is now a successor volume out, a successor to Empire, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire, Michael Hart and Antonio Negri. This one, a lot easier to read, mostly theoretical, but still a lot easier going than Empire. This one just out from Penguin Press. And I recorded the interview earlier this week with Michael Hart. And let's listen to the first portion of this. Michael Hart, co-author with Antonio Negri of Multitude, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire. Let's start with a topic that's on that just won't go away. It's on everyone's mind: war, war on terror, war in Iraq. You write about the history of war being conceived of as a state of exception, and now the exception has become the norm. Could you talk some about that?
Well, one way to approach it is through the tradition of constitutional law. There are many concepts in constitutional law for the ways in which the Constitution has to be suspended during times of war. It's a rather obvious or common concept, I guess, to all of us that during a time of urgency or emergency during wartime, certain constitutional elements have to be suspended. This is true in almost all, this is true in the say, constitutional relations of almost all states at war, all governments at war. The thing is that it's traditionally conceived from its from its origins in ancient Rome as a temporary phenomenon. There will have to be a suspension of the Constitution or aspects of it until the danger is passed. The question is today, if we have entered a state of war that's permanent or one in which we can't really see any end, then precisely that suspension of the Constitution of rights, the suspension of democracy, tends to become permanent. So the new kind of war that we're facing, it seems that Bush himself conceives of it that way now, as a permanent war, a war that you don't win. If the war is that way, then equally the suspension of democracy, the suspension of rights, the suspension of the Constitution itself becomes permanent.
Now, do you see this as something as a project of Bush or a party or a subset of the elite or something that's really characterizes broad structure of American society or even more broadly global capitalist society?
I think that probably one could approach this from certain currents within the Bush administration that this kind of opportunity to suspend certain rights, both domestically and then also suspend certain democratic relationships in foreign affairs, probably do fit in, are convenient for certain, let's say, elements of the Bush team. I'm much more likely to, and I find it much more useful to view these phenomena as structural and not tied to specific personalities. In other words, that I think that it's a condition of constructing global rule today, that there has to be both a permanent state of war and therefore this suspension of these rights. So I guess offer the alternative like you do. I find more convincing and useful the latter explanation when it doesn't depend on Bush in the White House or certain, let's call them neoconservative advisors, having greater influence, that it'll also have to happen, or there'll be extreme pressures for this, even if Kerry's in the White House or during a future Bush term.
So what happened? Why does the system, whatever exactly it is, have these needs?
I think that in order to understand how war has changed, one has to look at the, let's say, construction of the global system today. And it's one in which, in order to understand global relations, global politics, we have to look beyond the traditional nature of the relationships between nation states. I'm not saying, of course, that nation states aren't important and that nation states don't today conflict with each other. But the traditional way of understanding war, which was traditionally the conflict between sovereign states, is no longer adequate. That we have to now understand, well, Tony and I try to call it something like global civil war. In other words, to try to emphasize that there are non-sovereign actors as well as sovereign actors that are that are sometimes, in fact, even more important. So what we have today, and it's almost necessarily because of the global power structure, a continual conflict between state actors, yes, but also non-state actors, and that this changes the complexion and the nature of of warfare.
The soldiers who serve in Iraq and Afghanistan get medals that say GWAT, Global War on Terror. What exactly is this? And terror is a tactic. It's not an entity. So what do you think of this construction of a war on terror? Who is the enemy exactly?
Well, already in that formulation, I think in one of Bush's most lucid moments was what's
few
now...
Few and far between, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what's coded as a gaffe about a few weeks ago where he responded that the war on terror will never end, that it can't be won. I think what we have is something... Like, rather than we used to talk about low-intensity warfare, what we have is extremely high-intensity police activity. And it's police activity in the sense that, you know, police activity isn't won. Or if it's won one day, it has to be restarted the next. So I think this war on terror is a way of conceiving this high-intensity police activity, which doesn't have an end to it. Like, you're quite right, like you say, that the notion of the enemy has changed, too. So there's no terror. Is a, as you say, it's a tactic. It's maybe a set of tactics or practices or something like that. And so it's not defeatable, the way traditional enemies are.
Part of this war is also, seems to say, a stimulation of domestic paranoia and repression. You know, you can't take the subway without seeing a sign, you know, warning you about strange packages. And I guess people who were in Britain in the 70s were familiar with this, with the IRA, but you know, if you see something, say something. Now, having grown up in the Cold War, I was used to being stimulated with a lot of paranoia, but there's something seems different about this because the enemy is so diffuse. So what does that do to our, you know, day-to-day lives?
Well, I think one thing, like we were saying at the beginning, is that it's certainly an opportunity for those in the U.S., you know, those political forces in the U.S. or those political leaders in the U.S. that would like to retract rights that have been won before. So it's, I mean, think of the whole rubric of things that come under the Patriot Act. It provides an excellent opportunity for those kind of retractions of rights. I find it more interesting in a way to think about, you know, like you say, the nature of the enemy or the kind of paranoia that's created. With the Cold War, it's true that there was a kind of paranoia and a kind of communists are everywhere kind of thinking about it. But nonetheless, there was always behind it the notion of a sovereign enemy. There was always... The Soviet Union as the generator of these various spies or other sorts of
or plans. Its domestic representative of the party here.
Or its domestic representative of the party, you're right. But with the present configuration of terrorism, even the representative enemies are very thin, let's say. You know, it's not, of course, that Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein or, you know, go back a little further, I don't know, Gaddafi, Noriega, et cetera, all these various almost figureheads don't work very well. And what we have instead is a kind of autonomous seeming network that does lead to much greater paranoia, much greater possibilities for paranoia. And like I say, that paranoia functions with a closing down of democratic spaces within the domestic scene.
I should say I'm speaking with Michael Hart, who is the co-author, along with Antonio Negri, of Multitude, just out from Penguin. Well, let's talk about this concept of the network, which is very important in your book. What is this network? How does it characterize our world?
Well, there are very many ways. I mean, the network is a form that is in a way characterizing. It's our way of understanding so many things in our era. So networks seem to be coming up everywhere. I mean, understanding the structure of the brain, understanding how markets work, understanding how criminal organizations work. Networks seem to be explaining all of them. I think it's also true, and this is what we use primarily in the book, as describing the organizations of power in the world and of domination, that they are organized in a network structure. By this we mean that it's not as if one nation state is able to, or even a group of nation states are able to maintain global stability and global power on their own, but require a much broader form of power that's constructed precisely in a network form among the dominant nation states, along with the major corporations, along with various other international organizations, institutions, etc. So that this kind of network, this network of powers, is what is necessary today. That's our argument for creating global stability and keeping the rich rich and the poor poor.
You know, for the looks of it, it looks like the Bush administration was trying to assert a very traditional kind of American imperial sovereignty and authority, yeah, both domestically and internationally. What the events of the last year or two, how do you, do you feel vindicated in your claims about how that old model just doesn't work anymore?
I guess vindicated, yeah. I'm convinced, I might just be stubborn, that the efforts of the Bush administration and this the group in it that was dominant with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were doomed to failure. And they were doomed to failure precisely like you're saying, this is in my view, because they thought that the U.S. as the dominant nation state could, in very old-fashioned terms, repeat old imperialist projects and do them better, like as if they could do the British Empire better than the British did it, but with the same form of national sovereignty being imposed on foreign territories. I think that it's true today. I would say that whether Bush or Kerry wins this election, afterwards they are going to have to pursue some much more broader form of power in order to achieve what they want to achieve, in order to, in a way, counter the failures that they've encountered in Iraq. I mean, failures on anybody's terms, of course, in Iraq, that the instability, the increasing violence and danger to not only the U.S., but the European powers. I think that either Kerry or Bush will have to create a much broader basis for the imposition of power over Iraq and over the Middle East more generally, rather than relying on the old models, like you're saying, of the U.S. as unilateralist and in that sense, dominant and sovereign author of the Middle Eastern order.
And it looks like the resistance they're facing in Iraq is precisely the sort of network you've been talking about. It's not something that has an organizational chart and a hierarchy and a capo. There's a piece in the Canadian newspaper the other day, but someone who had been taken hostage and released and reported cooperation among all kinds of groups, Kurdish nationalists and different kinds of Muslim groups and all kinds of things. This is not a traditional kind of enemy that the U.S. is used to fighting.
Right. I think you remember those first days after September 11th when Bush and others were saying this is a new Pearl Harbor. I mean, in retrospect, it looks like, what would you call it, wishful thinking, that there was a Japan that then could be attacked and there was a sovereign enemy that could be identified and a coherent strategy made against it. You're right that I think that the U.S. government and the U.S. military, too, has been very slow to learn what seems to be an obvious fact to everyone, which is that these they are faced with a non-sovereign network of groups and these kinds of new enemies, these that are organized in networks, require a different form of military approach and a different form of power structure to create stability.
There was a cabinet meeting, I think, shortly after September 11th, when Rumsfeld said, "Let's go after Iraq because there's so many better targets there." Because it's something they could understand in that traditional way. Well, let's talk about a bit about the changes in the economy that you see. You talk about a lot about effective labor and immaterial labor. What do you mean by that, and what does this mean for politics?
Well, yeah, it takes there's maybe three steps in this, so I have to back up a little bit. I mean, but what we mean by immaterial labor is we're trying to grasp those forms of labor that result in immaterial products. The labor itself, of course, is always material, or it's always involved our brains and bodies the way labor always had. But the products are immaterial. So rather than automobiles and refrigerators, this is the kind of production that results in ideas or information or images, or like you say, affects, meaning interpersonal relationships. in a way, we're trying to describe in what seems to us a more general way things that go under the rubric of service work at certain times or communications production at others. So we're trying to group those together under this notion of what's immaterial, like products that are immaterial. This goes along in our argument with a rather general claim about the economy, which is that in each era, there's one form of production that's dominant over the others. It's not necessarily that it's dominant in quantitative terms, but rather that it imposes or its qualities are imposed on other forms of labor. So that, for instance, 150 years ago, industrial production was dominant, not because most people in the world worked in factories. In fact, then as today, most people in the world work in the fields. But it was dominant in the sense that the qualities of industrial labor, its working day, the social structures it required, the nuclear family, the gender division of labor, and its practices too, tended to be generalized over all other forms of production. So that agriculture had to industrialize, and society itself had to industrialize. So our claim today is that this immaterial labor that I was just trying to describe has replaced industrial labor as the dominant form of production within the economy. Again, not dominant in quantitative terms, but dominant in the sense that its qualities are tending to be imposed on other forms of labor.
And shapes discourse and consciousness as well.
And shapes discourse and consciousness in that sense that, you know, how we have a long tradition of recognizing how society has industrialized, you know, not only that labor, all forms of labor have industrialized, but society itself has adopted the kind of rhythms of industry and such. I think that today, too, this is what we have to say, what we claim really is that these qualities of immaterial labor are tending to be generalized, and so that the factories and industry has to become communicative and involve information. The same with agriculture, too, has to be take an increased focus on information, for instance, the information contained in seeds or the like. Now, if one accepts this hypothesis, it's obviously an hypothesis about the direction that the economy and society are going. If one accepts this hypothesis, then those qualities of this new form of labor or newly dominant form of labor hold great potential. And so we look at those qualities and say that what's the qualities of production and of labor that are involved in the production of ideas, of information, communication, also of interpersonal relationships, these are all based on processes of communication and of collaboration and cooperation that are newly incorporated into labor. So it's these qualities that we see being generalized that have enormous political implications and in a way provide a resource for thinking about a future politics.
And that's the voice of Michael Hart, co-author with Antonio Negri of the book Multitude, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire. Let's take a little break and I'll be back in a little under a minute.
Don't move, the man said. Where am I? Safe. Try to lie still. Did I get bit? The man laughed softly.
Hi, this is Carl Hyacin, author of Skinny Dip, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
Don't move, the man said.
And welcome to the second part of Behind the News. This is Doug Henwett, a weekly look at economics and politics. And we're hearing a long interview tonight with Michael Hart, who is the co-author of the book Multitude with Antonio Negri. And I should say that Antonio Negri in particular comes out of an Italian tradition of Marxism known as autonomism, which is famous for its emphasis on resistance, so that resistance is primary and that power always reacts to the resistance of the masses. Very relentlessly optimistic and dynamic view of things and a nice corrective to my own temperamental pessimism. Let's take a little musical break and I'll introduce the second part of the Hart interview. We'll be right back. that. An excerpt from the Internationalist performed by Utah Phillips and Ani DeFranco, the theme of the day. And let's move to the second part of an interview I recorded earlier this week with Michael Hart, who is the co-author with Antonio Negri of the book Multitude, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire, just out from Penguin. And I got to say, just as a sort of head note or parenthetical remark, that this use of the word democracy, I really, it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. It's something I want to look at in the future. It's just become this kind of empty word that everyone throws around that it could be used with almost equal lack of precision by George Bush and autonomous Marxists. It's we need to work on that a little bit. Okay, here's Michael Hart. Well, when Marx wrote about commodity fetishism, he was looking to the trade of trading of things that hid a vast network of relations between peoples, that markets were social institutions even though they didn't appear that way, and money was a social institution even though it didn't appear that way.
Yeah.
What are the similarities and differences in your view of things today?
Well, there are two things that they're slightly on one side and the other of the way you're asking it. On the one side, you know, when Marx thinks about cooperation in the factory, it's the one point when Marx really sings the praises of capital, because the role of the capitalist is to create and provide cooperation. The capitalist brings the workers together in the factory, gives them the means and the tools to cooperate with each other. Today, in contrast, in these kinds of labor, these labor that's producing information or affects, workers themselves have the means of cooperation. In fact, cooperation is created in the labor process itself. It's an object, in fact, of what's being produced. So that's one way in which there's a great change with the previous paradigm of production, and one in which workers are ever more powerful in certain ways. Let me try on the other side, too, which is that looking back also from our present perspective, it's quite clear that in the economy, what are produced when material goods are produced, producing a refrigerator, producing an automobile, in a way, those material objects are just a midpoint in what's really being produced, which are social relationships. Like the production of automobiles is really the production of a society in which people are arranged in automobiles, in their individual automobiles, etc. When we think today about these kinds of immaterial production, what's being produced immediately are social relationships, rather than the kind of midway point of the material object that then creates around itself a kind of social relationship. Let me give you an example. One of the examples we use is, say, flight attendants, which, of course, flight attendants, much of their work is material. You know, they provide a pillow, they do the safety procedures, etc. But a lot of their work is also what we call affective labor. In other words, they create a sense of well-being, or, you know, the flight attendants have to be nice to you. And you've seen it on the plane all the time. People are horribly mean to flight attendants. And they still have to smile and be nice to the people, like fast food workers, too, for that matter. So this creation of the emotional relationship, this creation of affect, is quite different than the production of material objects, and in some ways holds a great deal of potential, like that because the workers themselves are creating social relationships. Of course, they're social relationships under the command of the boss, and in that way, the experiences can be horribly alienating, much more than other kinds of work. You know, in some ways, you'd say, you know, I'd rather be working in a factory where they're in a way commanding my body to do certain things, but I'm free to feel or think the way I want, rather than having them command my ability to love or my ability to be friendly, you know, my social skills. And so on the one hand, it can be incredibly alienating, these new forms of labor. But on the other hand, I'm trying to emphasize the great, precisely political potential in it, which is that potential of the ability to create relationships of cooperation, to create interpersonal relationships.
I was speaking with Michael Hart, who is the co-author, along with Antonio Negri, of Multitude, just out from Penguin Press. Well, one of the things that Marx, that you alluded to, was praising about capitalism was that it yoked together workers who'd been working either in small groups or in families into large cooperative groups, and then, you know, created the possibility of a much larger, more utopian form of social organization. The kinds of production you're talking about hooks together people even over greater distances. They may not be in the same physical space, but people are linked around the world electronically or through other means. What does that say about the possibilities for politics of a more transformative sort?
Well, I think it does imply, well, you're right also that these, you know, the different technologies, the different economic forms, I think it's useful, at least as a starting point, to view each of them as having two faces to it. Like I was saying a minute ago, this kind of what I'm calling affective labor can be horribly alienating. On the other hand, it holds a great potential. I think it's similar with the kind of global networks that are increasingly constructed in the contemporary economy. Of course, with at different rhythms or something like that, and with steps back sometimes. In some ways, these globalized relationships can, of course, bring much greater forms of exploitation. Like even when we're connected to, I don't know, I'm connected through my tennis shoes with someone working in the Nike factory in the Philippines. It's a pretty powerless and even exploitative relationship. But if we can also recognize ways and transform ways in which these connections are made,
just something like the anti-sweatshop movement is trying to do.
Exactly. The anti-sweatshop movement, the sort of no-logo theme, also is thinking of ways that these connections that exist could that we could take control of those connections. I guess that's the way of saying it. We could take control of those connections and use them as a basis for political organizing and a kind of common political project.
And let's turn to the title of your book, Multitude. Just in the way that the 19th and 20th century industrial model created the proletariat or the masses, these kinds of economic processes you're talking about have created something called a multitude. Well, what is this multitude exactly, and how does it differ from concepts like the proletariat or the people or the masses?
There's one sense that we use it in which it might be thought of as very much like the proletariat, like referring to all of those who labor under capital. But what the concept tries to recognize is the way that that labor is organized to now in networks in which the laborers remain extremely different. Like that, of course, those working in agriculture and those working in industry or those working in these kinds of immaterial tasks that I've been talking about, their own conditions of labor remain extremely different. Like we'd say singular. They're the kind of differences that aren't reconciled. And yet they do have ways of communicating with each other and of collaborating with each other. So what the concept of multitude is trying to do is to at once recognize the plurality of conditions, you know, so that, and that's the multiple part of it, but that plurality doesn't obstruct the possibility of collaboration and working together. I would try, this is my slogan for multitude, would be that, or formula, there you go, is that multitude equals autonomy plus collaboration. So that in these economic terms, see, it would be like Lenin's old formula about communism equals Soviets plus electrification. Now, Lenin was much better at it.
He's a great slogan maker.
He is a fantastic slogan maker. But what I mean by this is that recognizing the autonomy or difference of each laboring population and the conditions under which they work, but nonetheless recognizing the kinds of collaboration that are possible between them. I guess that quickly becomes for us, too, the possibility of thinking of political organizing in these terms. In other words, go ahead.
No, I want to get to that in a second, but then also, I mean, you speak somewhat romantically of the multitude, as longing for democracy and cooperation and universality of a sort. But you know, the multitude also contains people who vote for right-wing parties, admire military discipline, beat up immigrants, long for traditional gender roles. How do these elements fit into the concept of the multitude?
Well, I guess there's one thing would be that we conceive multitude as a political project. You know, it's not necessarily immediately or spontaneously including everyone as they already are. It's because it's not just a way of conceiving the entire global population just as they are and trying to make it into some one thing. It's a political project in which we recognize the possibilities of different groups or different subjectivities, different laboring populations collaborating together and remaining different. So it doesn't necessarily, when you say that right-wing groups or anti-immigrant groups, essentially groups that don't want to collaborate, that don't want to work in relationships of equality and freedom with others, they aren't part of the multitude. I mean, because it's as we understand it, as a political project that that values the expression of differences, and at the same time allows for, creates the means of working together in equal and free relationships.
So the good guys, at least in embryonic form.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a political project of what we want. In fact, I would say it's at least one way, and maybe because I get too stuck in my own way of thinking, it seems to me the only way of thinking democracy, like of recognizing that people have to remain different and should and express their differences freely, and nonetheless collaborate or cooperate in the construction of society in a free and equal way.
Now, what does that say about the modes of organization? Then are we talking about parliamentary democracy or some kind of direct democracy or something that we can't even imagine yet?
Given that choice, I'd probably go for number three. But I think that
it's your job to imagine it for us.
I know. I think that, I mean, the first thing to establish, and, you know, there's limits to what one can do in a book, you know, with this kind of thinking now, because working out such possibilities, such political projects are things that aren't done, like, as you know well, these aren't things that are done by philosophers imagining blueprints on their own. They're such political projects are always worked out in movements. They're always worked out in political struggles themselves. So I think that the extent of our analysis here is, for one thing, recognizing how the structures and institutions and even the concept of itself of democracy as we've inherited it, primarily from the national formations, you know, within nation states, is not adequate for a global population. In fact, that it has to be reimagined, that it has to be constructed differently and even imagined differently on a global scale. So there's one side of it is that negative recognition that we shouldn't try to pretend that we could create democracy in the world today by simply blowing up to a larger scale, I don't know, the institutions of the United States, for instance.
But then you're also not looking to shrink it to some kind of like Bookchin-esque municipal face-to-face democracy.
No, absolutely. I think, though, that when we move from one scale to another, we have to invent new institutions and new ways of coordinating. Like, for instance, there's temptation when you look at many of the proposals of reforming the global system to make it more democratic. You see repeated a lot of often U.S. institutions, like that the U.N. General Assembly is something like the Senate for the United States, with one representative per country, like the two per state. So that what we need, many would say, is now a global House of Representatives, you know, call it a global assembly or something like that, that relates to population the way the House of Representatives does. I think that these...
Which would take like 20,000 people.
It would be quite a strange representative organ. I mean, I think that I admire people who are trying to think in this regard, but one quickly recognizes how much that imaginary and institutional conception that we inherited from the nation state is repeated so often at a global scale, and that we have to, I mean, the clear point, maybe it seems obvious to you, but it seems to take us a while to work this out in the book, is that one has to move beyond that and imagine differently what democracy could be on a global scale and recognize how different its institutions have to be. The level of analysis we're able to do in this kind of book is just to suggest the logic that institutions could take and what the resources are in the world today for creating a different kind of democratic institutions. And this comes back partly to what we were talking about earlier about the qualities of the forms of labor. In other words, that the kinds of networks that are constructed in collaborative productive relationships are that those kinds of collaborative networks, that kind of working together in networks that have no center of command but nonetheless function and function productively, efficiently, that those kinds of collaborative networks are one resource, say, for an institutional logic for new democratic relationships. There are always certain dangers in looking at the movements, you know, in the movements in the U.S. especially, as microcosms, you know, for how the world can be, because they're particular and isolated phenomena. But nonetheless, we can see ways, it's sometimes useful and suggestive to look at how people are organizing today and what that suggests about the possibility of new democratic relationships that could function on a larger scale. And it's precisely, I guess, what I'm trying to suggest is the same things that we recognize in the new forms of labor and the kinds of decentered collaborative networks that are involved in that production. It's very similar relationships we see in the, let's call them post-Seattle movements in the United States and Europe, especially. These democratic consensual networks that work without any center of dictation, not always well, of course, but nonetheless, that's part of the experiments, I think, and creating a new and new democratic structures that don't rely at least on the traditional forms of representation. It might be a new form of representation, or it might be is better conceived as a non-representative democratic form.
I'm speaking with Michael Hart, who is the co-author, along with Antonio Negri, of Multitude, just out from Penguin Press. Well, I remember being out in front of the Seattle jail in WTO week in December 99 and hearing the chant, "This is what democracy looks like." I don't know if that was the beginning of it, but that was the first time I became aware of the slogan. And still, the people stayed in jail. If we look at another model that you and others tout, the Zapatistas, they've been around for a decade, and they really haven't changed the Mexican state very much.
Right.
So am I just being too impatient, or do these models of organization, these sort of new institutional forms, have some power to change what exists, or are they just kind of fun ways to think about what might be?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing, though, is itself extremely important, that the kinds of relationships that the movements are working out are in themselves, I think, very important. It's a second matter, then, if the movements as they're organized now are effective enough to transform the existing power structures, you know, to topple the forms of power that we're faced with. And I think it's clear, as you're suggesting by the question, that that's an element that the movements have to face directly. I mean, that isn't yet resolved. I mean, that the movements have to work to make themselves more effective. I would just try to suggest, though, and this is the kind of way that Tony, my co-author, and I think in general, which is that we have to think forms of political organizing and movements for transforming the global power structures. We have to think that through how people work today. I mean, we have to think it through labor, if you like. And I don't mean this as an economistic argument. You know, it's not like everything is reduced to the economy and to labor. It has to do with people's everyday lives. You know, we have to ask, what are the capacities and talents that people have? And how can we make use of those in political terms? So that, you know, a factory worker in 1930 in Detroit, you might say that the capacities, the auto factory worker had great capacities, you know, knew about the entire production process. There's an enormous amount of knowledge. But in terms of organization, there was a certain structure that existed within the factory, a hierarchical one, and that required, I think, a kind of political organization that corresponded to that. You know, if they had a boss at work, they in a way had to have a boss in their political organization too. I think that today, if we look at the kinds of resources people have, based on how they work, by the kind of relationships that they are capable of and constructing, the kind of, what I would say, autonomous and collaborative capacities for organizing people have, precisely from how they work and at their work, that can suggest, let's say, forms of political organizing, and precisely based on their conditions of labor and what they produce. So I was trying to say, like, that was sort of a long route to say that for Tony and I, at least, in order to become effectively transformative, these movements and these political aspirations have to pass through the way people work and how people are organized at work and precisely traditional questions of labor, even though that labor itself has changed.
Let me bring this to a close, continuing this optimistic note that, well, a lot of left writing has historically been kind of gloomy. You know, the capitalists control everything, they manipulate us, everything's getting commodified, the world is going to hell, and, you know, now we have ecological catastrophe to worry about. You are different in that a lot of your writing is very optimistic and emphasizes the primacy of resistance over power. Could you just talk a little bit about where that comes from.
Well, I mean, in one sense, it's true historically, like that people have continually resisted forms of repression and have done so successfully. I think that, you know, you could just name your own pantheon of forms of repression and power that have been overthrown by those who've suffered from them. I mean, think of anti-slavery movements, anti-colonial battles. We have a whole list of victories against oppression. It doesn't mean that we've now reached a state, of course, in which there is no oppression, but I think there's no reason to assume that that history has stopped. You know, you might pose it, I think Tony and I could write this, even though it's sort of a wrong formulation, that there's nothing more natural to than that, call it an instinct, to rebel against forms of repression. And also historically, we have a long list of, a continuous list of successes in that sort of struggle. So I see no reason to think that somehow history has ended and we're no longer going to be able to defeat forms of oppression under which we've suffered. So that's the way the historical approach to it, that seems to me unquestionably true, you know, that we've had such successes in history and that they'll probably continue, or they should continue. The second is to look at, like I've been trying to say, the capacities that, you know, people have now. I guess it's partly, I mean, this is a conventional way of saying it, rather than viewing people who are oppressed as victims, recognize the powers that they have. So that sometimes talking about people as exploited rather than as repressed gives an idea of this, because we recognize that workers suffering oppression from their bosses, from capital in general, in fact, are enormously powerful. You know, they're not just victims. That women suffering structures of sexism, in fact, are not just victims, but are themselves enormously creative and powerful within the structure of sexual gender domination. The same way with other structures. I think that recognizing I guess that's part of Tony and my strategy that comes off as a kind of optimism, but I see it as just a realistic view of the capacities that people have, even though they're subordinated in the present structures of power. And so that on the basis of those capacities, we can argue for and even foresee the realization of a triumph against the current forms of oppression and the construction of something new and better.
There's lots of good stuff there. You just have to know where to look for it.
Yeah.
And that was Michael Hart, who is the co-author, along with Antonio Negri, of the book Multitude, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire, just published by Penguin Press. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. We'll go out with, we heard the hipster, a couple of hipster versions of the Internationale, one by Stefan Grappelli, another performed by Utah Phillips and Ani DeFranco. We'll go out with the old-style one, the Soviet Red Army Chorus. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week. Till then, onward.